The next generation of Galaxy is here, and T-Mobile is the best place to get it. With features like wireless power share, the only thing better than getting the new Galaxy S10 is getting it for free. So come to T-Mobile and get a free Samsung Galaxy S10e when you buy any Galaxy S10 device and add a line.
Via 24 monthly credits for well-qualified buyers. If you cancel service, credit stop and balance due. Contact us plus tax. Qualifying service, 2 or more lines and finance agreements required. Zero down plus $31.25 per month for 24 months. Pre-credit price, $749.99, 0% APR.
Sabrosura, papi, que
que. Hello, everyone. This is Pam of Café con Pam, the bilingual podcast featuring fearless Latinas, Latinos, Latinx, and people of color that break barriers, change lives, and make this world a better place while living in the U.S. Welcome to episode number 41 of Café con Pam. During this episode, we have a conversation with Natalie Torres Haddad, an award-winning author of the International Latino Book Awards of 2016, for her published book, Financially Savvy in 20 Minutes. The first Salvadorian-American woman to publish a book dealing with student debt. A workshop facilitator, a real estate investor, and a brand collaborator, a first-generation graduate and part of the 4% of Latinos in the U.S. with a master's degree, MPA from CSUN and from CSULB with finance and international business. Born in El Salvador, raised in Inglewood, she was surrounded by those facing permanent debt. Determined to be the exception, by age 24, she bought her first rental property and several after. She's also known for founding LA's Prom Closet and helped over 1,000 high school girls with getting prom dresses. Her activities have been covered in Huffington Post, LA Times, Fox 11, Univision, KCAL 9, La Opinion, and Toastmasters magazine. By the way, she's also a fellow Toastmaster. She's a host of the podcast Financially Savvy in 20 Minutes and Spanish podcast Financieramente Inteligente en 20 Minutos, interviewing self-made millionaires, tips, tricks, and tribulations on creating more wealth. First episode will be airing on September 1st. Natalie has traveled to over 30 countries. She's lived in Spain, France, and resides in Huntington Park with her husband and two dogs. Listeners, this episode was packed with a ton of financial information. I was really happy when I found Natalie, when I met her, and I was like, you talk about money? Because nobody talks about money, or at least I didn't grow up learning about money. So it was awesome meeting her. It was great talking to her. And the hour went by super quick, and we seriously are thinking about bringing her again because there's just so much to talk about. We didn't get to talk about her podcast, but she did give us a ton of tips on how to better manage our money. And we talked about the relationship that Latinos culturally, historically, we have with money, how we don't talk about it, how she purchased her first home. And I'll just let you listen to the episode. This episode was recorded at my house, so you will be hearing some airplanes and potentially my dog here and there, maybe, maybe not. And it was also a Skype call, so there will be a little bit of a distortion due to the connection. Other than that, I hope you enjoy it. By the way, we did not have a coffee break because the conversation was so good. I frankly forgot. I just forgot to bring up the coffee of the day. But the coffee was actually given to me by Nancy Salas, who is the wife of Jorge Narvaez. They are reality changers. They were episode 21, and they talked about parenting and family and a ton of other stuff. But they went to Hawaii, and Nancy knows that I love coffee, so she brought me some incredible coffee, Kona coffee from Hawaii, and it was amazing. So if you want to give Nancy some love, go back and listen to episode 21 and hear about their also incredible story. So thank you, Nancy, for the coffee of the day. And listeners, here it is. Let's take a look at Natalie's story.
Sabrosura, papi, que que.
Hola, Natalie.
Hello.
How are you?
Muy bien. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. We've been talking for a while, and we finally made this happen.
Yes, I'm excited to be here.
Yes, me too. I'm glad that you're a woman, and I'm glad that you talk about money, because this is something that I've been meaning to bring on the show for a while, and I'm just like, where are these women that talk about money? But I found you.
Yeah. I'm
I have
so
found you
connected.
For a while, but we made it happen now.
Yes.
Which I'm glad. Awesome. So let's talk about your story. So you are from, you were born in El Salvador.
Right.
And how did you make it here? How old were you?
I was a baby. So I not even a year old. My parents, my whole family fled the El Salvador during the Civil War. So we ended up living in Inglewood.
Oh.
And I grew up in Inglewood.
Wow. And then like that, you've never left, I guess.
They had the hopes that once the war would die down, they'd be able to move back. And 5 years into it, my mom could tell that it wasn't going to end. And it obviously took over, 14 years? It never really did.
Wow.
And so, yeah, we ended up staying and living in Inglewood. So I have been back many times. Since then.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was very different and very difficult for my parents to ever want to move back. Too dangerous at the time.
I bet. And they're together.
Yes.
Do you have any siblings?
My parents. One younger brother. He's 5 years younger than me. So just the two
five.
Of us. But we have we only have, even though there's only two of us, we have 26 cousins, and that's just from my mom's side. We have a huge family.
Oh my gosh.
Yes.
Was your family the first one that came from El Salvador to the States?
No, we were actually the last family to move to the States, but
really?
We were the first to become citizens. My mom studied in Chicago, I'm sorry, Illinois, when she was a senior in high school. So luckily she was fluent English speaker, was valedictorian. Like, so for her, English helped her and my family a lot.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you already, when you came, you already had relatives that were...
Yes, we had my most of my aunts, my mom's siblings, and their families were already here. But they all fled about the same year.
Wow.
During the war.
That's mm-hmm. crazy. So you really didn't have like a culture shock. You were little. And you grew up.
Yeah, I was little. So I didn't really have that culture shock. And I lived in Inglewood, so it felt like...
It's Latino
mostly,
land.
Most of my neighbors were, yeah, Latino. So you wouldn't really know the difference. And my grandparents, no one spoke English anyway. So
right.
It was, yeah, not much of a difference.
Wow. So you grew up during the LA riots. Let's talk about that.
Yes. I find it interesting now that more and more people are talking about this because mm-hmm. we just had the 25th anniversary of it. And I was a kid. I was 12 years old really when that was happening. And so lately I talk more about that because I have conversations with other people that are about my age. And if they weren't around a city where we lived, you weren't really affected by it.
Right. So for those who the people that are listening that don't know what the LA riots are, could you give a little background?
Yeah, a little background about that. So especially if you were in South Central LA, mm-hmm. Inglewood as well, where we live, this was the verdict that had really the first time that anyone saw a beating of a African-American, right? We had, I don't even remember how many police officers at the time, right? And it was caught on camera. And so unfortunately the verdict come out saying that they were not guilty. And this enraged not just the city that we lived in, many cities, because this was the first time it was caught on tape. And yet we've seen many, many times that something like that had happened or has happened, excuse me. And so like, how do you talk about that? I talk about it now kind of like it wasn't that difficult, but it was to see your neighborhood change completely. My home was such a happy place because we lived near our aunts. Like my neighbors were my aunts. They all had houses next to us. My grandparents and everybody bought their homes on the same street. You know, my grandparents were my neighbors to the right and my other aunt was to the left.
Nice.
And we used to hang out all the time outside playing with my cousins. Just we had such a great childhood. And when that happened, all of a sudden my parents, everybody was afraid to be outside. They didn't want their kids to be hurt in this, during this, like people were looting, people were stealing from local stores. They were burning local liquor stores, restaurants. Just this something that I think an image, a child doesn't know how to even comprehend what's happening. Mm-hmm. So we had to stay home more often. And then all of a sudden you see your windows be boarded up with, not boarded, bars.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's a really impressionable thing to see. And I remember my mom even saying a comment similar. She's like, we escaped the Civil War, but this isn't what we were expecting.
Wow, that's right.
And they came from a big city. They came from the capital. So they didn't live in like a field. They lived in an actual downtown, like LA city. And so they weren't expecting this at all. And because of that, this also changed my course of my education. So I was going to public school nearby, literally walking distance.
Yeah.
And my mom said, we're pulling you out and taking you to private school.
Wow.
So junior high, I ended up going to a private school, and that was a culture shock because here I'm like the poorest kid coming from one of the, you know, nearby cities. And all of a sudden you see like how some wealthy family lives, and your high school becomes too another culture shock where a lot of wealthy families, the way
so that was a culture shock.
That was more of a culture shock for me. Yes. And so that really just changed my path instead of staying in Inglewood too, particularly where there was a lot of gangs at the time to a lot of rivals. Especially if you're Salvadoran, which I am, at the time there was a lot of animosity between Mexicans and Salvadorians.
Yes.
You know, obviously the culture behind the war, everything that goes with that. So being around that really affected. And I think what you talk about, a culture shock. So students that were my age, you know, my friends, when we talk about the LA riots, they're like, what's that? Or it didn't affect them. And I'm like, you're only two cities away from where I live,
wow.
Right? And I go, so you've never seen a prostitute on the street, or you've never seen blood on the floor, or you've never seen a gang fight, or you've never seen a drive-by. For me, it was like a what?
Yeah.
None of that had ever been in your lifetime. I almost assumed that everyone had at least seen something like that. And I knew our neighborhood was not financially set, you could say, because we were already struggling before the riots hit.
Mm.
So being Latino primarily too, most cities don't really care, or at least they didn't providing the funds that you need. And I also lived in a part of the city where LA County has certain parts that are unincorporated parts. So that means they don't get the same funding that the rest of the city does. So even though I live particularly in a little square mile called Lenox, it's like less than a square mile, we were poorer than Inglewood, the city, because we did not get the funds that the city provided. So,
wow, I didn't
yes.
know that. I know where Lenox yeah, so, is. That's
yes,
interesting.
If you ever fly by the airport.
Yeah, my family lives in Inglewood.
If you drive by, there's still some streets, I kid you not, that if you drive by, it still looks like it's Tijuana. And it's literally in the city. And it goes to show where the funds are not being allocated.
Is there a reason why?
It's in an unincorporated city, and they have not changed it to a corporated part. And I don't know what the procedure on that goes, but a lot of politics goes with that.
Wow.
And yeah, so it's very interesting.
So how was it going to from public school, from coming from Inglewood to a private school? Did you face any like discrimination or?
Awkwardness. So to give you a reason was I remember having to work harder for my grades too, because at my school, my public school, I was a straight A student. I was even advanced to some, you know, AP classes. And then I got into private school and I was behind. I had to get tutored, and they said, you know, your education's actually a little behind. So that was a little awkward, along with just kind of not understanding that not all parents work two jobs. Both my parents worked not only two jobs, maybe sometimes they both work two jobs, working full time. And then you see parents that, oh, if your mom stays at home or your dad works part-time, how does that work, you know? and then you had some with, you know, wealthy cars, and then the homes, very different than what we grew up in. I never felt poor, but you definitely start to see the difference of class when you're thrown into that, where you're like, oh, yeah, I can't afford that. Or even if I ask my parents, they look at me like, yeah, that's not going to happen.
Did you ever kind of resent that you weren't able to meet those quote-unquote needs?
You know, I think I always, my parents did such a good job of instilling humility and being grateful for what we have. So I never felt that I was, resentful in that. I sometimes felt, maybe sometimes resentment, now that I think about it. But I think sometimes I just felt I didn't understand what that meant, or how is it some groups can excel, and then why is it that it's taking us so long just to be met halfway, or to meet halfway, or, you know, get some of those means. And for me, I think seeing even other Latinos that were wealthy Latinos, you know, different and shock, you know, it's like, especially my parents were really young when they had me. They were both 21. So most of my friends' parents, especially white kids, they're like, oh, my parents had me when we were like 40. I'm like 40?
They waited a long time.
Yeah, I was like, my parents aren't even 40 yet, you know? So
oh my gosh, that's right.
Yeah, imagine. So I remember some of my friend's parents, they're like, oh, your parents are so young. And you know, Latinos, we age well, thank God.
Right, right.
So you see my mom and she looks like she's my sister.
Right.
And till this day, I look back, I'm like, wow, how awkward that
must have been. Did your sister drop you off today?
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, no, you know, they're trying. So being exposed to that was also an eye opener. Like, oh, I'm definitely going to college. And my parents didn't steal that. And those schools, especially that private school, was about pushing you to go to college. They had, you know, prep classes, even workshops for your parents in the evening. Like, so it was a very preparatory school. And most of these students were outstanding students, you know, 4.0s, surgeons, of, you know, just great outcome, you can say. So I think that was another awkwardness for myself, because I'm like, some of my friends that I grew up with that went to different schools were not having that conversation at all. So,
right.
About money, about student loans, none of that was being talked to them at all. So, yeah.
So that, do you think that definitely helped push you to the path that you're in?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think one of the things, and I think this is in life, when we're surrounded by people that are doing really well, we want to do just as well, or we at least we have higher standards. And for example, I still remember a valedictorian had like a 4.6.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, 4.6. I think went to MIT, but you know, got accepted
for sure.
to every at Ivy
least.
League school. And most people had like a regular 3.9, 3.8.
A regular 3.9.
Yeah. And so I was like, okay, barely 3.5, barely. And that was like really good. And then I was below average. And then I remember some of my friends going to the nearby high schools and they're like, oh yeah, valedictorian had a 3.2. And I'm like, oh no. So you really do. Yeah. You really do see, well, the lack of resources, money as well. And focus that they have. Mm. And most people don't know private school teachers get paid less than public school teachers. So the ones that were at our school had been teaching for literally decades. They loved what they do. Mm-hmm. They really did. Mm. Granted, it wasn't fair enough that they weren't getting paid much, but that was a big difference as opposed to some schools that people are just there kind of for a paycheck, even though it's not a big, big paycheck at all either. So education foundation for me really changed my outlook and made me start to ask those questions. Why don't we have this type of money? Or why don't we talk about money? Or why is this such a taboo, especially in our culture?
Why do you think that is?
One, I think the lack of it. If you don't have it, you're embarrassed to talk about it. You're ashamed to talk about it. Or if you feel if you are asking those questions, that people will give you the same answers. And so, unfortunately, our Latino culture has that negative connotation that maybe we shouldn't. I think not just the lack, if you do have it, I think there might be the sense of envy or, and we have that saying that you don't want to be presumida. You don't want to be that conceited person. And to tell you the truth, I didn't start telling people I bought a place when I was 24 till a few years ago. They knew I had bought a place, but they didn't know how early and they didn't know.
They didn't know the details. Yeah.
Because almost kind of, you don't know how people will take it or it's just kind of strange,
shame.
But I think it's part of that culture. Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And why do you, because the money is something that I feel like you, that it's not talked about enough, and especially in our culture, and nobody like sits you down. Like I have my white friends that my best friend, for example, her parents sat her down and they were like, this is how you do a budget. Nobody told me that.
Yes. Nobody does. We also learn what our parents did, right? So on a lot of my workshops, I'll even say that. I'm like, so if you remember when was the first time you experienced watching your parents pay bills, right? At the kitchen table, all frustrated, you automatically associate that's a horrible thing.
Right.
To do.
It's a condition.
And they don't sit you down.
Conditioned. Yeah. It's so sad.
Yeah. Yes. And they don't show you. And it probably is because they don't know themselves too. So we repeat that cycle. As women too, we're not taught that, which is unfortunate. I know it's starting to change, but I love how you said, oh, you're the first Latina woman that I've come across, because I totally understand. I remember reaching out to a friend, or I call it a friend now, and I'm like, oh, you're Latina too, which is awesome. I go, because there's very few women, let alone Latinas, talking about finances. And one thing that really caught my attention was, wait, it's not just that Latina women in general too, we're told to marry well.
Right.
You know, don't worry, your partner will take care of you.
Yes.
Or
is that conditioning?
You know,
we grew up conditioned to expect to be taken care of and not really take care of ourselves.
Yes. And I'll tell you this is something how I know I am very fortunate. That's why I feel like it's a, not only the privilege, but it's part of my responsibility with it to talk about this, is because I came from a home that I did not get that message at all. Both my parents, my dad and my mom, were like, you are not going to rely on anybody else. You got to be able to take care of yourself. And that way you'll find someone that will be happy with that too, a good partner that can take care of themselves as well. But it will be more of a partnership than not kind of like the, you're yeah. being taken care of.
I'm
right?
waiting for you to save me. The princess yes. type of story.
Exactly. And my grandmother was the same way, my mom's mother. She even said, always make sure that you can take care of yourself, because God forbid, if your partner gets hurt or dies, you're left with nothing. That's something that happened to my grandmother as a child, that she had to take care of her younger mm-hmm. sibling. So that's something in my head where I was like, okay, I got to get all this stuff done before I settle down. And I always imagine. And so for me, I didn't get married until I was 31. And that was considered old. And, you know, our
oh, yeah, for sure.
Right. And for me, I think, well, we should be able to do what we want to do. And it's funny because I have a younger brother who's 5 years younger than me. And luckily he got the same message I did, take care of yourself, all that stuff that goes with it. But I see a lot of my friends, family members, people I've never met, they'll say, oh yeah, that's the first thing they told us as kids. Like, oh yeah, your husband will take care of you, or find a good husband. But I was like, oh, that doesn't guarantee anything.
Right.
And you should have that pride. And at the same time, there's such a worth to that, a value that you get from knowing that you're contributing to your community, to your society. Yes. And for me, it was that I knew that I could take care of my parents or my grandparents or anyone that I need to, including myself. Right. So, and I'm sure my partner will appreciate that too. So
totally.
Yeah, finding the right person.
Well, because men, and I have a lot of male friends, and they do prefer, like, it's hot even, you know, they say mm-hmm. when I meet an independent woman, it's like, dang, you got it. Okay. You don't need me, you know, like, because it's not, they're breaking that stereotype of women wanting the men to take care of them.
Oh yes. And I, you know, that's something I love what my husband told me. That's how I knew. I was like, ooh, I like this guy. he even said jokingly at the time too, he goes, Well, I go, do you feel intimidated by, you know, if a woman makes more than the man or that kind of thing? He goes, oh no, I'm cool with you being a sugar mom if you ever want to be. And I said, okay. I go, I don't think I will be, but if that's the case, I'm glad you'll be happy with that.
Then we're good. How did you meet him?
Undergrad. We were actually friends for a very long time, and, you know, went our separate ways, grad school separate ways, and then reconnected through MySpace. Okay.
No way.
But wow. We're just like, yeah, let's hang out again. And he actually came back and said, oh yeah, let's, why don't you and I just hang out this time instead of involving everybody that we always did. And I'm like, okay, like a date. So yeah, there you go.
And you never thought when you were friends?
Say it again.
When you were friends, like before, did you ever think like, oh, maybe I could date this guy or?
No. Well, oh, I thought he was so cute the first time I ever saw him. Right.
What's his ethnicity? Is Haddad his last name?
He's Arabic.
Okay.
So, yeah, let's talk about another conversation we can have, right? So him and I were just friends, and I think he had a girlfriend. I had a boyfriend with many of them because we knew each other for a long time then. But I never really saw him like that, I guess. And I think that's what made it easy too, because we were just friends. And yeah, I just kind of, okay. And later on, you never know, you end up marrying that person.
For sure. So how was marrying someone from a different culture?
You know, it's funny. His background is Catholic, or his family grew up in Catholicism. So talk about being...
Is he Chaldean?
No. So that's a different...
That's Arabic. Okay, that's Iranian. Yeah.
But right. So the whole structure there. But his... he has Chaldean friends. But my husband grew up in Azusa, which is in California, right?
Yes.
And it's primarily a lot of Mexican. One of my best friends is his best friend from childhood. And she's like, oh yeah, growing up, I always thought of him as a cousin. Because they have very similar culture.
Yeah.
Arabic cultures are so similar to Latinos. His mother is so, I love her. She's like, the first time I went into his house, I said, oh my God, you're straight up Mexican. Like, I know you're Latino, which is pretty bad. And he's like, that's pretty awesome. And he goes, why? He goes, cause your mom had, and he even warned me. He's like, oh yeah, my mom has Virgin Marys everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
And she had my favorite painting in the, it's a painting with the Virgin Mary, and she has like the bushy eyebrows.
Oh.
So it has like the Arabic features. And I was like, wow. So, the values are very similar, very family oriented. And so it was very easy culture for me, and I felt very at home. Mm-hmm. And my parents felt the same way. Once at first, you know, everyone's kind of like, wait, Arabic, how'd that happen? You know?
Right.
And I'm Salvadorian too. I on top of the, they didn't know any Salvadorians. They thought we were all Mexican, you know?
Yeah. Of course.
Yeah. Or being exposed to that, it was kind of, it's still a lovely mix. And I think that's the fortunate part about being from LA is that you're surrounded by all these cultures, have so much similarities, and the things that were very different, I love learning about, and money is one of them we talk about too. And our culture is very different too, which is really cool. The side note, if you want to know, and I think this is part of what also got me to talk, why we want to talk about more about these things, is in their cultures, they even keep books of like when you give wedding presents, birthday yes. presents, they give money, you know?
Yes. Did you have a traditional wedding like in his
yes.
culture?
Yeah, and my culture, yeah, so we had a traditional Catholic wedding to please our parents, basically.
Yeah, of course.
I said, let's just elope. And so it was interesting to hear that it goes back generations, and I thought, wow, their families have kept literally accountant or bookkeeping from generations prior, which I was so impressed with. And
wow.
I know Asian cultures do this too. And so...
But what do you mean, a book that says how much you got for your wedding?
It's a libro, a book straight up that the, like, so-and-so family gave you this much. So that way you know how much to give them, or just at least you have, yeah, it's a very detailed process. And for Latinos, that's so weird because we're lucky if we get presents sometimes, you know?
No, you get the dollar dance and you get like $1 per person.
Oh my gosh. Yes. So exactly. It's called, the dollar dance. I'm like, it's not a dollar. It should be more, right? But, and so they give tradition of giving money. They give traditions of helping the family, that kind of sense. And so they keep a track of this. I was very impressed with it. And one of my friends who's Korean, she said, oh yeah, we do something very similar. We give money. And I was like, it's a different concept. And yes. one thing that we don't, even with our families, our cultures, we don't talk about it early on enough.
Yes.
My friend who's Korean, she said she remembers sitting as a kid on Saturday mornings or Sunday mornings doing 4-hour math classes.
Wow.
And yeah. So instead of, and I was like, oh my gosh, you know, we were doing Saturday mornings or Sunday. We were at the soccer field because we were all playing soccer, right? So for them, they start off even before they're in school, like kindergarten, pretty much taking intensive math courses at an early age. So when I hear people say, oh, it's because Asians are good at math, I go, first of all, it's a stereotype.
Right.
Yes, a lot of them might be because literally they start,
because they start when they're born.
On. Yeah. So I thought that's brilliant. Why not start teaching? Because math, business, financial literacy is literally another language.
For sure.
So you have to start early on
if
possible.
And it creates that relationship with money. Because I mm-hmm. feel that because we don't talk about it enough, then we grow up with this like fright, como se dice, like miedo,
si?
You know, like
mm-hmm.
at the money.
Fear.
Yeah, the fear of money, because we're like, oh, we don't know. This is like a foreign object. This is a foreign thing. And then it's just like you kind of roll with it, but not really do it in a smart way.
Right. And we repeat the same cycle.
Yes.
Sometimes it could be a good cycle, meaning we know, I like that our cultures will teach us to, if you earn money, you donate a portion of it, hopefully 10%, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that I do love about our culture. However, we also learned some of the bad cycles, right? When I say, like, paying your bills, this is something I always tell people, you have to enjoy when you're paying your bills. And this is a big tip that I loved. I've learned so many from my mentors, my family members, but instead of having that, like, sitting
dreadful
at the
time.
Table being... Yeah, you're like, great, I got to pay bills. I make it a pleasant experience. More than anything, I look forward to it. And let me tell you why. I have to tell you, because it's one of my favorite things that really make me appreciate what it is to be not only financial literate, but take a responsibility of your finances.
Mm.
So for me, this is what I do at least twice a month. And my husband knows when I'm doing this too, when I'm paying my bills. I got a candle going, usually like a lavender candle, something you can play like, right?
Yeah.
And have that burning. I have music in the background that I like to hear that's going to relax me. I have my chamomile tea because it's calming, right?
Yes.
I'm not going to get stressed. Even when you don't have money, you got to do these rituals because
right.
it really makes a difference.
Right.
That's going. I have everything that I need in my box. So like my letter opener, my stapler, my stamps, my tape, whatever it might be. Most of it is all paper format still.
Really?
Not online. Yes. And this is where a lot of people have the controversy that, oh, it should be online. That's what the banks want you to have. They want you to have all your bank statements online because guess what, guys? It becomes spam.
Yes.
So you don't even look at it. So you'll get charged for fees. Yes. You'll get charged for stuff you didn't see.
Yep.
So for me, you have to have it hard paper. So then you are forced to go through each item line and see, okay, does this match up with my receipt? Is this accurate? And so the best part about that, once you, and only time yourself too, so you don't feel like, oh my God, I have to sit here for 2 hours and kill myself, right?
Right, right.
I'll say half an hour, I'm paying my bills. As soon as you get faster with it, it becomes easier. Once I'm done, I reward myself. So it either is like a nice bath or, a, you know, those 20-hour foot massages that we have everywhere. Those or ice cream or just something that it's a ritual that I know I will have once I've completed this task. And it's a pleasant one. And I always say, give thanks to what you're doing. So when I'm paying a bill, I say, I'm thankful I have a mortgage because I have a roof over my head, right? I'm mm-hmm. thankful that I have bills because I have electricity, a phone, I have running water. Those are things you learn very on when you're traveling. You're like, oh my God, hot water, right? We don't have any, right?
Yes, for sure.
Right? I'm thankful for having employees. I'm thankful for paying people for their jobs. I'm thankful for helping their family. So those are the things that you have to keep in mind when you're doing that. So that's something that could be a good cycle in the traditional list to sit by the kitchen table and be frustrated, right?
So a habit is really good. I like that. So listeners,
yes.
And you do this twice a month?
At least twice a month, depending. I try not to do it too often. Yeah. So it's like usually my bill days are like the 15th and a couple of days before the end of the month. And it shouldn't be too often, but enough that you know, especially if you're getting all your bills on the same day, which is good. You should have that so you're not like, oh my God, did I pay that on the 12th and the 13th, the 14th? Have it all on one day. So you have to call this company, say, I want everything on one day. And it just makes it easier. Mm-hmm. And you either look forward to it or at least you know, okay, I'm going to get that done out of the way tomorrow.
So right? You don't have any automatic auto payment that come out of your bank?
Very few. Some of them are because you don't really have an option. Mm-hmm. Very few have that, right? So it might be like, I'm trying to think what, there's one that doesn't really give you an option. But I,
like the
only reason why, the gym or something, but I prefer most of them, I can have that paper and I pay it because then what happens if you do automatic, you could get overcharged, or you get double charged. And the worst part is sometimes when you become automatic paying it, you're almost kind of like, oh, that's the easy way. I won't check my bill because it's already paid for.
Right.
Right.
So you recommend people looking at their bill, like reconciling.
Absolutely. Before paying it. And I think that's something that it's kind of like working out, right? So they say if you want to work out, you got to put in the time, right? Go to the gym, got to eat right, all that good stuff. And that's part of being financial literate is taking the time to make the budget, balance everything out, make sure you have enough to pay and some savings and everything that goes with that.
Do you do, because I've heard, and I do this actually, what is it? 50, 30, 20? So 50% for yourself, 50 fixed. So 50% like bills and whatever.
So it really depends too. Well, it depends on the person too, right? So especially if you have family, if you have student loans, right? That's another we can talk about.
Yes.
And it depends where you live too. I know the standard that most people will say 30% should be for your living costs, right? So like your rent or your mortgage. And in LA and parts of California, it's more than that.
It's 50.
Yeah, it's really difficult. So learning to find to live below your means is important. Sometimes that means especially if you want to own, living in a city that's, actually let's talk about that real quick because you just said 50%, right, of what you have. And it depends where you're living too, right? So for me back, and this is something that's helped me now, back then I wasn't too proud of or too happy about it, but now I look back and I'm like, thank God I was listening to my ultimate goal. So the first place that I bought that I lived in was in Long Beach, and not the nicest part of Long Beach, let me tell you. So I remember even taking my parents and they're like, oh my God, why are you moving here? And we lived in Inglewood, so it wasn't like,
right.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was like, thanks a lot. You know, thanks for, you know, always, they were already scared for me, basically. But when I said, it's not only something I can afford, but it actually was below my means. Mm. So I wanted to make sure that I didn't want to be worrying about, oh my God, how am I going to pay my rent or my mortgage, right? And it also allowed me not to have to feel this pressure to keep up with the Joneses. Mm-hmm. And that's a big difference. There was a time that I lived in Manhattan Beach for about a year.
Wow. 20,
and
that's expensive.
Yeah, and it was But I was subleasing, but even that, it was so expensive.
Yeah.
And it was right near the beach and it was awesome. Don't get me wrong. But I thought, oh my gosh, how much money I spent during that time, because you have to keep up with being at the beach, eating out, and just having a great time.
Wearing the clothes,
Yeah, all that stuff that adds up. As opposed to there, I was like, okay, you know what? That money that That money that I was saving, I could use for travel, which I did. That money that I was saving was going to be for the longer run. And I remember when I had my first housewarming party, I was by myself. Well, I bought it by myself. And so it was a 2-bedroom, 1-bath little condo. And it was a foreclosed property. And
in Long Beach.
So I got a great in Long Beach. So it was a great deal. This was around 2007, right? So I remember having a little housewarming party, and I think it was 700 square feet. So like good size for us, right?
Yeah.
Especially from LA. And everyone's like, most of my family and friends were not only excited for me, but they were like, are you sure you're by yourself, or can you handle that? Or why here? You know, you could rent in a better place. And I totally agree with them. Like, you're right. I can, but it's not going to help me in the long run, whether I decide to be here for a long time or eventually sell it. So I had to keep myself in check to know that it's not instant gratification that I'm getting. And it was a decent neighborhood. It wasn't bad completely or anything, but I knew my ultimate plan. And that's what I tell students now, especially those that are back in school or in grad school, living below your means, especially our culture and our society, we're consumer based, right? The nicest cars, all these things that we get bombarded by, right?
Whole image.
The whole image. And for me, I lived in Spain for a while. I lived in France for a while. I've traveled to other places, Central America, and even in China too. You don't see people having the best cars. It's like old cars. It's not a big deal. Even their homes hardly are ever really upgraded. And I think, and so being exposed to that, I'm like, yeah, I don't really need that. I'd rather spend that money traveling or something towards my investment in the future, right? For whatever it is.
Yeah.
So I think somehow I've disconnected myself from that, but it's sometimes very difficult, especially in Los Angeles, where it's like everybody is with the latest trends, the fashion trends.
Oh yeah.
Trying to keeping up with the Joneses, right? In my book, I put keeping up with the Kardashians, because this one had just come
right
out.
Right then?
Like everything. And it's that where I'm like, don't fool yourselves, people. They either have the money for it, or you have people that are living way above their means.
Right. It's just for the image.
Exactly. So you kind of, going back to your question of how much you should have, ideally to be safe, 30% should be towards like your rent. And it depends on the person, how they feel about donating. I would say like 10% if you can, but a portion of that will be obviously another portion will be for your utilities, your expenses. Mm-hmm. But this is a common mistake that most people do. They pay all their bills first. And then what happens? Whatever's left over is for me.
You pay yourself first.
So you got to pay yourself first. I like how you said, and it's true. You pay yourself first, at least 10%. So it's kind of like that. Money gone, you don't see it, put the money somewhere else.
Yes.
So we have to condition ourselves to do that, because it's not, at first it's hard to do. I remember the first time I learned that concept, I'm like, that's going to be hard.
You're worth
and then
it
after, it's totally worth it. Even if you're starting off with just a dollar, literally teaching yourself how to do that, it just becomes a habit. So I think, if we learn to figure out what our percentages are that are comfortable, especially if you have kids, if you have student loans, which is another one, our generation isn't talking about, we're ashamed to talk about our own financial future and present, really, because our parents, especially if you're a first generation college student and dealing with student loans, student debt, your family doesn't understand what that means.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can have $500 that's just going to literally one student loan.
Yeah.
And that's, people are like, wait, that can pay for part of my mortgage or part of my rent.
Yeah.
And so being able to advocate for that, that's something I talk about. That's not just students or anyone's student debt, is because we shouldn't feel ashamed of it. We need to also educate our families about this.
Mm-hmm.
For the main reason is they expect you to be at every quinceañera. They expect you to be at every wedding. They expect you to be at, you know, destination wedding nows or whatever it might be. When you're like, wait, I still have to pay for my student loans.
For my education.
I still have to pay for my rent. Exactly. My education, that's going to take how long it is, right? I wrote an article on how fast I paid mine down, but there's a lot of sacrifices that comes with that. And not everyone has that option. But if we start to let our families know and our friends to stop putting that pressure on us and understand that you're coming from a different place. Because I had friends and family that went to college, either was paid for or got scholarship. I didn't have that luxury. I had some scholarships. I definitely took out some student loans. And I would think about it, and I'm like, yo, I'm paying my student loans. You have $500 left over for whatever you want. It's a very big different lifestyle, especially as a recent grad.
Yes, yeah, for sure. So let's talk about the LA's prom closet.
So that was something... And I always feel like I identify with that as well, because so it was a nonprofit that I had for about 7 years, and it came from a dark place, meaning a dark time in my life. And I share this story with people now because you'll never know when something can be life changing or beautiful from those moments. And I see you shaking your head because you know what I mean.
Oh, yeah.
You totally know what I'm saying. So for me at the time, you know, I was working full time. I was in my mid 20s and I had just come home from a fourth funeral I had gone to in 2 months.
Wow.
And this one was from a cousin who was 21, a car accident. It was horrible. And I was, for the first time in my life, very depressed. I couldn't stop crying and I didn't know what was going on. And so that sense of not having any control in my life, I was just sad. And I remember in my apartment, I didn't want to cry because I didn't want to make my roommate all sad or just freak out pretty much. And I remember looking up and my closet door was open. And it was a mess. So I started taking stuff out, right? And I came across my prom dress. And I thought, you know what? I'm never going to wear this again. And I'm sure I had a bridesmaid dress too, by the way. So thinking, a lot of my friends have these same dresses they're never going to wear again.
Yep.
So I called a few of them up. Some of them were my sorority or they were longtime friends. And I said, what if we gather our dresses and we help girls go to prom and, you know, pay for their shoes, makeup, whatever they need. And within 2 months, we got 300 donations, dress donations. And my goal was to help 5 girls. That was it. That's okay. Hey, let's help 5 girls. We ended up helping 45 girls right
away. Nice.
And then it grew every year. I think we got to a point, it was at least 300 girls at every event. So we were so lucky and ended up helping over 1,000 girls.
That's awesome.
And these were, it was really cool. And it was during the time during the recession. You know, a lot of girls were recently homeless. Their parents had lost their jobs. They were living in someone's garage because they lost their homes.
Yeah.
And market was really difficult. And prom is expensive. It runs from
it's a quinceañera.
To 700. Yes, it's like a quinceañera. It's like a wedding.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. So, and I thought, you know, this is the last time for them to be a teenager, the last time to want to celebrate that they're graduating from high school. And so it was a really cool experience. And that's when I also started teaching my financial literacy courses in my workshops, because I was 26 when I started it. So I didn't tell anybody that I actually was the founder until 3 years into it. Cause everyone's like, oh, you're the kid or you're the volunteer, right?
Yeah.
And it was a volunteer organization, right? So I wanted these girls to understand that they can do something like this and not have to feel that they can't afford it or they can't figure something out. Bartering is a huge thing, especially as business owners. How do you barter your, how do you make money off of that too?
Yep.
And so I started teaching the financial literacy side on how to get scholarships, how to pay for college, how to deal with student debt too, because that's a reality as well. And having them, giving it little hope that it's going to be okay and not to worry so much about, oh, I can't afford to go.
Mm.
And that's what I hear, especially Latinos, especially in our cultures. I hear a lot more and more saying they won't go to school because they can't afford it.
Right.
And
many times.
Yeah. How many times do you come across someone like that?
Every time. And I interviewed Quetzal Mama. I don't know if you've heard that episode.
Oh, yeah. I'm working with her. I love her. We're on a book
thing. Oh, you're on the book thing. Yeah. Yes. I know. I saw the pictures. This is a whole nother story. I was like, oh my gosh, I know these two women. That's awesome.
Yes. She's amazing. I love her.
Yeah. When I spoke to her, I was like, where were you when I was going to school?
Exactly. I love her book. And it's that too, where I'm like, if we have these resources at hand back then, how different our lives would be now, right?
I know. But now we can help others avoid these mistakes.
And that's what you're, exactly. That's what we're doing. We're like, we'll voice it and we'll let you know who to contact. Yeah, you're right. Because I think that's what breaks my heart more too, where I hear people say, oh, I'm not going to go back to school. Or I'm not going to go to grad school. And, you know, or maybe they will, but they're going to do it the long route. So instead of graduating within 4 years, they're going to take 10.
Because
they don't want to take out student loans. They don't want to deal with all these things. But the problem with that too, and this is something I learned early on, is that you also miss out on those opportunities that you could start making money much earlier that will help pay for that.
Yeah.
And for, unfortunately for Latinos, they don't see that. And I see more and more, at least this is a comment I get a lot. They're like, well, you know, I could be the next Steve Jobs, or I could be the next Mark Zuckerberg. Or I'm like, okay, first of all, very different.
Right.
Unless you're coding and doing all these amazing things, I get it. But I also remind yourself that I'm a person of color. So and I still get this, by the way. So, you know, you walk into a place and they think you're the secretary, or yes, they think you're, you know, the cleaning lady.
Yes.
And I think I had an epiphany not so long ago. At the beginning of the year, I met this awesome, she's a doctor. She's been a doctor for two decades. Also a real estate owner for decades. Went to Harvard. I mean, she's impressive yeah, Latina. And Salvadorian too, I believe. Yeah. And she was telling me that her tenants too, or people still think she is la señora que cuida los niños, right?
No.
The kid, the lady that takes care of the kids. Mm-hmm. When she goes to collect, you know, whatever, she has to go to a property for some reason, they ask her, oh yeah, where's the husband? Or where's the landlord? Or,
oh,
you know,
my gosh.
And I thought, oh my God, that never ends, you know, and she's this well, you know, amazing lady too. And I'm like, so it doesn't matter how old you are, it, you know, the color of your skin, unfortunately still, we have that negative connotation, even within our own culture.
Oh, for sure.
You know, so I think that's something, it's also important for women to hear this. Like, your podcast is helping other women to understand, oh yeah, there are not just Latinas, but women talking about money. Something that I encountered that I thought people were encountering, and I knew my colleagues weren't, when I would ask them, they're like, oh yeah, we never dealt with this. When I remember signing my, you know, your closing documents, I remember the loan officer was like, it's like, are you sure you want to do this? You
know, I got that too. When I signed mine, they were like,
yes, right,
take a deep breath and think about this. And I'm like,
yeah, I'm like, okay. So yeah, you kind of start shaking your head and you start doubting yourself. Right. And so
yeah,
I remember him saying, are you sure? Not even just him, even my own family members. I had people like, you're not going to do this. You're not married. You're not going to do this with a husband. Or
yes,
are you sure not with your co-sign with your parents? Or when it was just, I'm like, first of all, you're looking at my bank statement. I can't be here if I didn't have the money for that. Right.
Right.
And I thought, okay, maybe this is a normal question, or maybe because I look young or whatever, or I was young. And I asked my colleagues who were guys, not one of them got that answer, that question.
Huh.
And I don't know if you remember, there was an episode on Sex and the City that also reminded me that it didn't matter if, as a woman, you were still going to ask this. Miranda, who's the lawyer,
yes,
was buying her condo, and the guy even asked her the same similar question. And I'm like, oh, you know what? It doesn't matter if you're like the white lady that with the lawyer, they're still going to ask
just
you.
Just for being a woman. Yeah.
Yeah.
Where's the husband?
Yeah, exactly. So it's important to know that there are women doing it. And so you should be doing it too. And don't doubt yourself, because that's something I remember doubting myself. I'm like, well, maybe I shouldn't be doing it. Everybody mm-hmm. around me thinks this is crazy.
Maybe I'm
even
too young for this.
A little nervous.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. So what happened with the nonprofit?
Mm-hmm.
After how many years?
So after 7 years, a lot of us got burnt out. Honestly, The majority of my board members were all like what you call badasses, you know, in our mid-20s. Some of them had started grad school as well too, getting married or having their first babies. We got burnt out. And then luckily we actually helped five other organizations start their own nonprofits.
Nice.
So we gave most of our stuff to them, because it costs thousands of dollars to start, you know, the racks, the, you know, all the merch.
Starting a 501c3 is a lot of money.
It's a lot of work. And I learned the hard way too. I'm like, oh, I could have got a fiscal sponsor, and then we did find one. And so that's something I was teaching them to do. So I'm like, don't put yourself through all this headache.
Yes.
And so one of the organizations, she's awesome. She's still doing it. We gave her all our stuff. And then it just kind of helped us to kind of, I said, if we're going to do this again later on, we'll do it again. Maybe when we're retired now, because we were just obviously young and doing everything. So that's something that we just kind of, a chapter in my life. And I think that's something important to talk about when it comes to finances too, where even if you have your own business or your side hustle, or just trying to figure out your next career move, or if you're not working, try to understand, take time for yourself and ask yourself, okay, is this purposeful for me right now? Or is this something I can come back to later? Or is this something that just has had its time? Mm-hmm. And for me, that was a very difficult situation. Or time for me to think that, but it was also good for me too, because then I thought, you know what, I can help so many more if I focus in other areas. Like for me, it was financial literacy, and I can eventually fund it myself and all that stuff, because that's something I did see that was, I'm like, wow, it would take me longer to get a donation of like $100. That took me how many days to get that, when I could have just funded it myself. I was, you know, so those are the hard things I learned about the nonprofit sector. So I always tell people, you know, if you find yourself, ask yourself if this is worth staying with, mm-hmm. moving away from, or coming back to it.
Just putting it on hold. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. That's how I met you, right? We were at the conference. Mm-hmm. I love that. That was an amazing conference. And hearing people willing to not only maybe able to look at their life now and all the path that's taking them to where they are now, is it worth it to move forward in their business? Is it worth it to move closer to whatever it is in their career? It's so important to be able to have those, that distinction, because then you can make better financial decisions instead mm-hmm. of kind of like, eh, let me just whim it.
Right.
So that's something that allowed me to move away from it. But it was always something I love talking to people about, especially girls, young girls that are afraid to start something, whether it's a nonprofit or a business. I'm like, just do it. You'll figure it out. And don't be afraid to do that, because if I would have waited, like everyone says, I'm going to do something, I'm going to do this
when I'm ready.
Do it. Yeah. Yeah, when I'm ready. Same thing with my book. When I'm ready, or what? No, just do it. And sure, it's never going to be perfect, but you learn, and the next time it'll be easier and it'll get better, and you find the right people that have that skill that will help you. So
totally
just do it so you can learn.
Yep. What did you learn from buying your first house at 24, your first property?
What's
the biggest learning?
So the biggest learning was to do research.
First?
To research, meaning I bought around the time you probably bought, when you were talking mm-hmm. about getting ready to lose something.
I bought in 2006.
Okay. Yeah. So right before everything really crashed,
and then
right?
Crashed in 2008, and that's when I dropped it.
Yeah, and that's what most people did. Mm-hmm. I had this conversation recently with another lady who had 4 properties and lost it. Yeah, so, and she's young too, so it's just that. My thing was doing the research that really helped me with that property. I used to be really embarrassed to talk about that property because I didn't make any money compared to like some people that were making money. Also, I was embarrassed to talk about it because a lot of people had lost a lot of money and their homes. So I almost felt like, let me brag about my,
right,
even though I didn't make any money, I broke even. But it was such a good learning experience because that was when market was hot. Everybody was like flipping, buying, mm-hmm. selling it quickly within a couple months. And I learned to ask questions, and I felt like that's stupid little kid. You know what I'm talking about? You're like, why?
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
And so when I'd ask people, especially seasoned investors, I'm like, well, what about this? Or why is the market going so quickly? Or isn't this bound to fall? And when I would ask questions about foreclosure, people were like, oh, that's not going to happen. They were completely wrong. Right.
Yeah.
And so I was so afraid of that first property. Oh my gosh. I remember I actually found this in my journal a few weeks ago. Me writing, I took out $926 out of my account. I needed at least $5,000, but that was like the first chunk that I took out.
Yeah.
So I could buy that property, or at least the down payment, right? And the funny thing is that I remember how scared I was to do it. And obviously all the paperwork and all the...
It's a lot. It's intimidating.
It's very intimidating. And so, and I did it with a partner so that we could do it, right? And so it was so nerve-wracking, and it was in a place I'd never been to. I mean, or knew. I've been there. It was Florida, but in market, not from where I'm from. And I freaked out, but I remember thinking, okay, this doesn't make sense. If people are constantly buying and selling within this area, of course the valuation's going up, but that can't be the only reason that we think we're going to do well with this property. So like, if we buy and then we'll sell and make a profit. And so I freaked out, but it was part of my gut instincts and asking mm-hmm. people questions that weren't giving me the right answers, or at least the ones that made sense to me. And I said, we got to get rid of it, sell it. That lady that we sold it to, she made $30,000 within 2 months. She sold it. She resold it. She was a seasoned investor. And the way we worked it is that I said, we buy this place if we have a buyer for sure, in case we don't want to keep it for the long run, right? So that's one thing I learned from many, many classes. And luckily we had her, and she's bought tons of property. And she said, fine, we'll buy it from you. So we basically broke even, pay for everything, clothing costs, all that good stuff that was done.
At least you didn't lose any money.
Yeah. And that's what, now I look back, I'm like, oh my God, I learned so much from that. And she made $30,000. And I kid you not, 5 months from that, the person, whoever bought it, and people in that, I still know people from that area that bought, lost everything. Like, so if we would have held it 8 months, I kid you not, from the day that we bought, 8 months, we would have lost everything. I know people that lost their retirement account. They lost their investment money because the market crashed.
That's crazy.
And isn't that insane? And so I remember my partner was pissed when he found out she made 30, but then he came back like 5 months later to thank me. He's like, that could have been us. And so that was a really learning experience that, you know, threw me in the water. And then so the second time around, it was still scary, but not as scary. And I knew what questions to be asking. And mm-hmm. that's what helped me buy the foreclosure, you know. And so that's the learning experience I learned, that not to be afraid to ask the questions and do the due diligence and just ask. And if it doesn't feel right, you know, you'll learn from something from that. And I really did.
For sure. Oh my gosh. We could sit here and talk about money for like hours and hours, but you have things to do. I have things to do. I want to respect your time. So you have a book. How did the book come about?
So my book, yes, I wrote this. I journal like every day. I journal a lot. And it's just about 5 minutes that I journal, which is in the morning, right before I get my day going.
Really? Is that a habit?
It's a therapeutic habit. It helps release any, our mind thinks of way too many things. So it's a great way to just get rid of your ideas and just kind of move away from it. So I journaled for a very long time. And in college, right before I graduated, I was freaking out that I'm like, I'm going to have so much debt. And how am I going to deal with this? So I started writing out little plans on how I would pay it down. And then.
And you didn't have a job line.
And I didn't have a job lined up. No. And so, you know, just kind of how much I'm going to make my first year and all these goals that I had, right? So I started writing this little thing together. And then I still remember we were happy hour with my girlfriends and two of them were talking about how am I going to pay for my rent? And now I need to buy a car and how am I going to pay for my student loans? And another one was talking about, yeah, like she's not sure how she's ever going to be able to buy a place. And here I was sitting, I remember, oh my gosh, I'm about to buy my first place. Right.
Yeah.
And then yet I also, most of them had help with their parents or the parents helped them through college, right? Paid for their college. And I'm thinking, how is it that I'm financially a little better off? That didn't make sense to me. Right.
Did you work? College?
I worked full time in college, except for 1 year when I got scholarship. I went to school full time, so that was really cool.
What was your job in college? Your full time job?
I had so many jobs. So on the weekends, I worked as a catering server. So I worked 20 hours on the weekend at least, and then for a catering company. And then during the week, a child development center, 4 hours a day. Right.
Okay.
And then I had my first business, which was, I was a children's entertainer. So I was Mulan,
princess
in Spanish, but girl, I was making $130 an hour. I did four parties a weekend and those 4 hours is what I was making during the week, you know,
for sure.
So that's kind of how you learned, you know.
You would save that money.
I would save that money because eventually my goal was to live and study abroad. And so all this, okay, you know. Okay. And then,
so you had a plan all the way.
I always had I was a planner. My mom says since I was a child, a planner. So during that conversation in the cocktail hour, my girlfriends are like, Nat, can you give us some advice or some tips? And I go, yeah, you know what? Maybe I can put some stuff together because I told them, oh, read all these books, you know, like the big gurus that I'm like, read up. But they're not reading any of it. So I said, you know what? Let me write something for you, girls. So I did. Like a little, they probably still have it too, which is so embarrassing, but this little, like 20 page of my top notes. And first that actually came out to be like a big, thick book. I'm like, no one's going to read this. And so I condensed it enough that I said, if they can read it in 20 minutes, I'm happy that I taught them one thing, meaning it's like a language. I'm not going to teach you A through Z. I wanted to teach you at least the basic
conversation
first thing that can help.
Hello, how are you?
Just
how you doing?
Conversation. Yeah, the A, right? And then hopefully that would get them excited to learn more. And my mom helped me. She's like, you know, I loved her. She's like, why don't you call it Savvy in 20 minutes? I'm like, oh yeah, financially savvy in 20 minutes.
Nice.
And I gave it to them. And at the same time, I was teaching these exit loan classes at the universities and same questions that they were asking me. I'm like, I'm going to put that in the book. And it really helped them as well. So it was this quick guide for them to just be able to live a normal life, right? If you want to go to the bar, if you want to enjoy being single, living on your own, all that stuff that comes with it and dealing with student debt, I wanted to make it easy for them to understand. And so it just came about. And then years later, I got this award last year for it, which was really cool. And the best business book category. And I did it in a Spanish version too, because more and more people are like, we need this for our parents to understand it. Whether your parents don't have, you know, they can understand a little bit about what you're going through, especially as a millennial, you know, they don't understand any of that.
Right.
Living on your own, not getting married right away and having kids. Right. So I wanted to have something fun. And it really was how that book came about. So if there are any writers out there, I encourage you just write what you have because you never know that it might be a book later on. And
for
that's
sure.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Awesome. Okay,
thank
so
you.
We're out of time. Oh my gosh. What are some like tips that people can find in the book?
What are the
chapters?
Yeah. So there's some tips that I always talk about runaway spending. So talking about, you know, just like one of my favorite ones that people always laugh when they read the title, they're like tipsy, overspending while tipsy.
Yeah. Yes.
And I just recently came out with a video on that and it was just kind of talking about some tips that you can do. So the first one I would say is if you can take cash for the night, not a credit card, because with the credit card, we're like, let's leave the bar, the tab open.
Mm-hmm.
You overspend and the next day you regret that you spent, you know, how much money, you know, taking way too many drinks. And then don't do rounds. I know this is a difficult one for most people. Unless it's like a really special occasion, don't do I'll do the first round. Because what happens is, let's say you're only going to buy maybe two or three drinks for yourself. You end up buying how many? Five, six drinks. And we know drinks are not cheap.
Yeah.
And then you get really drunk and then you end up spending more. It's just not worth it.
And typically and so by the second round, everyone's like, okay, we're good.
Yeah. So then you're like, great. I'm stuck with the bill, right?
I know. And if you're buying, like, you really don't want six drinks if you're buying for six people.
Exactly. You know? So, and it's okay to say, you know what, guys, let's just get our own drinks. We're good. And now things, now we don't have to drive anymore too. So we could be responsible in the sense of, you know, like, let's have a little pre-party at our place before going to a bar or a club. And I think that's one thing I wish my friend's girlfriend that I said, we wish we would have done too, because then you're not like, okay, who's going to be the sober driver? Who's going to spend all this money? And those are the things that I'm like, you could definitely avoid that and still enjoy the night, still have a good time and not regret it later on the huge bill the next day.
Oh yeah.
One of the fun ones that, and that's for anybody, that's just not any student, but takeout, we spend so much money. And I always talk about how one little meal like that can cost you $10 can end up costing you literally $2,400 in just from that one meal. So if you're spending 10 bucks a day, let's say on breakfast or whatever it might be, and you know, people spend breakfast, lunch and dinner, and everything else. So it's assuming we're conservative and it's just that one meal for 10 bucks. You multiply that five times a week because you're doing Monday through Friday. I don't include the weekends because our cultures can be either very expensive or you don't spend that much unless you're not going out, right?
Right.
So Monday through Friday, let's say you're working and you're spending 10 bucks a day, it's 50 bucks. You multiply that by 4 weeks in a month, that's what, $200?
Yep.
So you're like, $200, okay, kind of adds up. But then you multiply that by 12 months, that's $2,400.
Yeah.
So you're thinking, I could have spent that and used it for my credit card payment to pay that off or gone on a trip or do something better with it. And I tell people that's really conservative because Christmas time happens. What happens? You spend so much more money. So eating out can be one of those places that people don't really think twice about it. And you spend so much money instead of literally maybe cooking 3-4 meals or maybe 2 meals a week can make such a big difference.
For sure.
So meal planning. Those are some of the, exactly, meal plan, your belly, your body will thank you for it too. Less takeout food. Another tip I always say also is, we talked a little briefly earlier, was the paper statements.
I like that
checking,
one.
Yeah, check your hidden fees. Phone, your credit card, hidden fees. Banks are known to make tons of mistakes, and most people don't catch it. And it's like, a few dollars here and there adds up.
They add up.
So those hidden fees is a huge one I talk about as well. And so many more other tips, but I think those are the top three that I see people don't really walk away, and then they think, oh my gosh, that soda can or that coffee cup really cost me this much in the end. And it's not worth it when you can make your own at home or at least cut that in half.
Awesome. Okay. Very nice. I have so many more questions, but maybe you'll come back for another episode for a second round of financial literacy.
I'd love to.
Okay. So where can people buy the book?
So people can buy my book directly through my website. It's a Financially Savvy Latina, .weebly. So that's one of the things. Oh, and why it's Weebly? Because you can have a free website as well. Most people think you have to spend all this money on it. That's one way of doing it. And I'm also sponsored on different sites, so you can get the book as well. And you can reach me directly through my Instagram and Facebook, Financially Savvy Latina.
Okay.
But that's an easy way to do it. It's also available ebook in Spanish. So
in Spanish, ebook. Very nice. Mm-hmm. Awesome. And is it on Amazon or directly on your site?
Directly on my site. Yeah. Okay. I don't have it on Amazon. I was thinking about there's a part two coming out, which I'm really excited about. That goes more into detail, like for those that are trying to buy their first place and just a little more details of like the next step.
So you'll come back for the second book then.
Okay. I'll be happy to, more than happy to. And so, back then too, when I came out with the book, Amazon was charging, it was 60%. And I'm like, out of the cost and everything. Yeah. Things have changed, luckily, with the ebook that works with, but granted, I wrote this book in 2012. So, and it's gotten so much traction in the last few years where we've seen tuitions hike. This past year, we saw the triple hike in the Cal State system. So it's really helping students that are going through literally that student debt.
Awesome. Very, very nice. Well, I'm excited to hear what the listeners think about this episode. I think we packed it up with a ton of information, and we can definitely come back with more. So if people have any questions and they want to know more about what you do, what are your handles?
Yeah, so my handles, Financially Savvy Latina. It's two V's, right? So Savvy, S-A-V-V-Y, Latina. I'm on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, same name. And my email is financiallysavvylatina@gmail.com. So feel free to ask questions and contact me. And I do events all over, and those book tours that we're doing, all that fun stuff that comes with it too. So we have free workshops that you can attend as well. So definitely feel free to hit me up.
Awesome. And now you are with this group of Latina authors, which one of them is Quetzal Mama.
Yes, I actually started that group. It's called We Are Latina Authors. And it's a group of Latina authors, published authors. More than half of them are award-winning authors too. And we're trying to promote more and more women telling their story, Latina particularly, obviously. And most of them are local, and we're working with so many. I'm actually doing an international workshop. I'm so excited, in Puerto Rico next month. And being able to, because I'm being contacted, I'm lucky enough that someone's emailing me that I've never met that wants a workshop. And I thought, you know what, there's a lot of Latina authors that don't have that privilege yet. So I said, you know what, I can team up with these ladies, help promote their book. Like Quetzal Mama, she's an amazing, her books are amazing.
Yeah.
You know, how to get yourself into an Ivy League school. She's awesome.
I know.
So I thought, you know what, I can help her as well. She can help. We help each other so much as well. But being able to collaborate as a group, you do so much more promote more women. And hopefully maybe you'll come out with the book, which would be awesome with all these stories. These women that you interview, just imagine the book that you can provide. The trailblazers, you know. And I think most women, or most people, don't see that as, it's another source of passive income too. So.
For sure. Well, thank you, Natalie, so much for being here, for sharing all of your tips that are amazing. I think a lot of people will definitely benefit. Do you have anything that I didn't ask that I should have?
We definitely need to do a follow-up because there's so many things.
So many. I know. So many.
Anything I asked? No, yeah, I think you hit right on the point. Oh, maybe a motto. I think that's one I think it's important to talk about, kind of your purpose.
Yeah, well,
right?
I still have my last two questions.
Oh, you
questions.
Got this. Do it. Two questions. You got it. You got all the questions down.
Yes. So we actually didn't have a cafecito break right now because we just didn't, but we'll talk about. Do you drink coffee?
Yes, I love coffee.
How do you drink your coffee?
I love my cafe just black. I love it. My husband is a big coffee person too. So we have like the French press. We also have the grinder at home. It's just, I love my coffee black. So
that's the way to drink coffee.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm a barista.
I like it. Yes. Yeah.
So I make coffee and I'm a big coffee drinker for sure. Mm-hmm. The last two questions that I ask my guests are, number one, do you have a remedio, a remedy, a little something that you use? You talked about the chamomile tea and your twice a month bill paying.
Right.
Do you have another one?
Another
you
remedy,
always do?
Like, I treat myself. Yeah, remedio. To put myself in a good place. I think that's something, a remedio that I do, and I do this every single day. I meditate for at least 13 minutes. So if that means I have to set my alarm earlier, and it's usually the first thing that I do before I do anything else. So I try to do it when before anybody else wakes up in my house. So 13 minutes at least of meditation.
That's awesome.
And that's it puts me in a better mood and just kind of clears my head.
Me too. I meditate too. And it makes such a difference when you don't. I notice it. My day's just like a mess. Because you don't ground yourself and you don't set up your eye like that. And then the last question that I ask my guests is, do you have a quote or a motto or a mantra that you live by that you want to share?
Yes. So my quote that I live by is I don't want to just survive life. I want to thrive in all its glory. And I feel that's exactly my life. That's just, I want to take advantage of it. And I think a mantra is something that I picked up when we created LH Prom Closet with the group of my friends. And the motto was, and I still to this day live by it, love it, is sometimes achieving a larger dream means first making the small ones happen. And it really
that's powerful.
Sticks to me.
Very nice. Yes. I love that. Well, thank you again so much. I'll let you get back to your day.
Thank you.
The time.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. Thank you. And we'll definitely have a follow-up. I think talking about money is something that, you know, I have the monthly Humble Therapist where we talk about mental health. I think we should have a monthly money session.
Oh, girl, we can have a whole conversation on mental health and how it relates to money.
Experiences,
all that stuff. Yes, please do.
Yes. I was actually, and then we'll close. I was talking to a friend about the relationship that we have with money and how it's emotional.
You know, gosh, totally.
Yeah, for sure. But we'll get to that on the next episode. Thank you again so much. And listeners, don't forget to subscribe on iTunes. Subscribe, rate, and review if you think that this episode is worth sharing to someone, which I think it is. Just forward it to a friend and have them take a listen. And if you want to be so kind to me and leave me a review, because that means a lot. And it also helps with the visibility of the show. The more reviews we have, the more iTunes promotes the show. That's just the way it is. For the non-iTunes users, you can go to your podcast listening platform of choice. We are everywhere. And if you have one, the Cafe Con Pam is not there, let me know. I'll put it on. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, send me an email to pam@spreadideasmovepeople.com. Like Cafe Con Pam podcast on Facebook, follow on Instagram @Cafe Con Pam podcast, and join our Support Brand Podcast Facebook group. We are getting a ton of people there, a lot of podcast hosts that are there, and it's a lot of fun. Support me on Patreon, patreon.com/Cafe Con Pam podcast, and visit spreadideasmovepeople.com/podcast/41 to take a look at the show notes. Thank you, Henry, for the music, and listeners, stay shining. Sabrosura pa tu que que.
With the Capital One Quicksilver Card, you earn unlimited 1.5% cash back on every purchase everywhere. It's easy. That's just the way I like it.
Oh, that's the way, I like it, That's the way, I like it,
Woo! The Quicksilver Card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
That's the way,
Capital One Bank, USANA.
At the Home Depot, the start of spring means it's time to add Vigoro and EarthGrow colored mulch to your list and your cart. Right now, get 5 bags at a special buy, just $10. Mulch helps retain soil moisture in shades of red, brown, or black. Hey, it's nice out. Today is the day for doing and mulching. With Vigoro and EarthGrow colored mulch, 5 bags, $10. Only at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. Color selection varies by store. Limit 60 per customer. Continental U.S. only.